Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What scars would the horrors of the Holocaust leave on a young child? As the daughter of affectionate, financially stable Hungarian Jewish parents, Zsuzsanna Ashvat was happy and secure in her early childhood. But as the death grip of the Third Reich tightened over Europe, her family couldn't shield her from bitter grief, crushing hardship, and terror. The family survived in part due to the extraordinary courage of the 23-year-old Gentile nanny who had worked with them for years and who repeatedly risked her own life to help Ashvat, her parents, and her older brother find places to ride out the occupation. Zsuzsanna Ashvat is Leah and Paul Lewis Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of Literature and the History of Ideas at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her new memoir is called When the Danube Ran Red. Zsuzsi, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You start the book with this really haunting story of a little girl's birthday party when you were just 8 years old. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I have heard about terrible things regarding the Germans, although I didn't exactly know what they were. I just knew that several people who fled from Austria and Germany to Hungary were talking about terrible events. Usually I listened, but then I also left because I was afraid. But I don't remember anything very clearly until I was invited to this birthday party of my friend Martha. And there, while we were standing in line for a cake, for chocolate cake, a little girl about whom I knew that she and her mother fled from the Germans, from Poland. And I knew that her name was Hannah, but I didn't really talk to her often, but I saw her on the streets. She came to me and she said, you know, here I am and my father is not here because he was shot together with my grandfather at the marketplace. And so I was looking at her and then she told me this horror story, and she was crying and sobbing, and I stood there with her, listening how she and her mother and her father were taken away, and all of their relatives in a small Polish town, and taken to the marketplace, and how her father and grandfather were separated from them, and then how the men were shot later, while the women and the children were standing there and for a whole day and then taken to the ghetto. And from the ghetto, she was then freed by her cousin who took mother and daughter to Hungary because the mother was Hungarian originally. And her parents lived in the town where my parents and where we lived. And so that's the way that they got there. And she was telling me these horror scenes of shootings and people. And I could think of only of one thing, that we will be shot as well because we too were Jews. She told me that this is what the Germans do with the Jews.
Was this the first time not only that you understood exactly what that meant, but the fact that was this the first time you understood that it happened to real people and people that you could know?
Yes, because it was her father.
Yeah.
And as she spoke about her father and how much she loved him, I automatically thought of my father, whom I loved so much, and whom I was always so much afraid, about whom I was always so much afraid that nothing will happen to him. And I think that the reason and the roots of this fear lay in the very fact that I heard stories from Austria and from other countries where they have done terrible things to the Jews. And so I was just terribly afraid of that. And here she was, who fled from Poland, and she talked to me about the way that they came by car and about her cousin and so on. and so forth. But she was frightened to death, and she was sobbing. And the only thing that I imagined that I would sob like that, and maybe I would sob more, and maybe something horrible is going to happen.
So you went home and were very upset by this for weeks and months and years. And it was such an insane time that unlike parents in other situations whose kids are worried something will happen to them, they could reassure you, but you always sensed they couldn't really.
No, they tried to reassure me. And as a matter of fact, my father has often finished his discussions when I somehow tried to force him to talk about it, what happened in Poland and what happened with Hannah and what happened then elsewhere, because we had more and more acquaintances and friends who came from other countries to Hungary. That was not a country that was not occupied by the Germans. And my father always said, yes, this could have happened in Poland. Yes, this could have happened in Czechoslovakia. Yes, this could have happened elsewhere, but it wouldn't happen in Hungary because the Hungarians wouldn't let it happen.
Of course, your father had already, as a young man, experienced anti-Semitism and, in fact, violence.
Yes. He was, as a 20 years or 19 years old university student in pharmacology, he was thrown down the stairs in Hungary in 1920, it must have been, when the counter-revolutionaries have taken over the power from the communists. And the Jews were, of course, accused of communism in Hungary, and that was a good excuse to beat up university students in the universities, which you couldn't enter a Hungarian university because it was regarded as an extraterritorial place. But as soon as you left the classroom and stepped outside, you were not anymore in an extraterritorial place. Mm-hmm. So you could be caught. And there were hundreds, probably near 1,000 university, Jewish university students who were beaten up. Some of them got injuries for a lifetime. My father, too, has been beaten up terribly, and he just came home from the front where he was injured, and his head was operated. He had a head shot on the front, and this was maybe a half a year or a year later. And I don't exactly know the year when this happened. They were waiting for him, and so he came outside and stood at the top of the stairs. And they caught him and beat him up and threw him down the stairs so that his head bumped against every single stair as he fell down, rolling down to the street. It's about, I would say, two or three floor high, maybe four floor high.
So despite having endured this, in the interest of trying to comfort you, years later when you were a young child and you were worried, he would try to reassure you. Clearly there's nothing more frightening for a child than seeing that their parents feel frightened and helpless. And there was a day that you remember your dad coming home early from work, which he never did.
Yes. That was when the Germans occupied Austria. That was in March 1938. And my father came up to the apartment and he made this one statement, everything is over. And I understood that everything is over, so that something horrible has happened and something has come to an end, and something new will happen that is horrific. I didn't exactly know what that meant, but later it became clear to me, my mother has explained to me, that what he meant was that the Germans went into Austria, and the two countries then united. And I knew that because he said that everything is over, that there is no hope anymore, he somehow foresaw Hitler's expansion all over Europe and probably the war as well. So he said everything is over. And this resonated in me forever.
And your parents did try a lot of different ways to get out of the country, or at least get you and your brother Ivan out of the country, but they couldn't do it.
No, they couldn't do it. I mean, they tried to get to this country. There was no possibility for that. They tried to get to Brazil. They started to study Portuguese. Someone has promised them that Brazil would take us. They have tried everything that looked at that time as possible. There were various ways in which they were promised to be smuggled out to Romania, and from Romania they were told they could mount ships and go to then that time Palestine. But nothing came from any of these plans, and they were just left alone, and they could not flee, and they could not go. And they themselves, I think, were terrified of these insecure, unsure plans.
Talk about how your mother handled the stress as compared with your father, because it seems like they had different ways of trying to get through this.
Yes, I think that my mother was terribly frightened, and that in her own way, she foresaw that what will come. Somehow, she foresaw the destruction. She foresaw that we will be homeless. She foresaw that we will be threatened. My father, I think, foresaw really the Holocaust. I think he really was aware of it, that we are going to be killed, all of us, despite the fact that there were times when he believed that we will succeed and everything will be okay. So it went up and down. I am not exactly sure what was told to me and what he really felt, but sometimes he looked really very calm and very happy, saying that we are going to survive and everything will be fine and the Germans won't occupy Hungary and we are not going to fall under these laws and regulations and we are not going to be taken away from our home, while my mother always thought that we will be taken away.
What a burden to carry when you're parenting small children and you don't know how much to tell them and whether you can protect them from the information or not.
That's right. I think that they have suffered tremendously because of this at first and later on because of what has indeed happened. But I think they were constantly, enormously frightened about us, and that they were really afraid. They had a feeling that we will be able to survive, and then they had a feeling that they cannot do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So both feelings were very strong.
Zhanna Ashvat is my guest. She is Leah and Paul Lewis Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of Literature and the History of Ideas at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zhanna Ashvat. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red. So when your father had his pharmacy, he had hired a young girl who was supposed to work in the pharmacy, but your brother, who was, I guess, a toddler at the time, absolutely fell in love with her.
That is right. Elsie was at that time not yet 13 years old. She was the daughter of terribly poor parents. Her mother was a washerwoman. Her father was a bricklayer who, however, wouldn't get any job because in 1919 he joined the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. He came to Hungary from Slovakia, and he joined the Communist Party because they have promised, I don't know, a better way of life or whatever. And when Horthy, the governor of Hungary between 1919 and 1944, when he took over, they have completely decided against giving ever anyone a job who was in the Communist Party, who has shown any kind of communist tendencies. So that poor man who barely knew Hungarian and who has really been just by chance and under the circumstances, under the pressure of the circumstances, he had become a communist. By now, he wouldn't get a job. I mean, not even a day job. Not even any kind of job, basically throughout all the time. So he became an alcoholic. He was beating his children. They lived under such incredible misery and poverty that it is really even difficult to explain. I mean, they didn't have anything to eat and so on. So they sent their children to work. And Erzsi, who was an excellent student, the best in her class, who wanted to go to high school. She wanted to go first to junior high, then to high school, the Hungarian version of it. She dreamt about becoming a doctor. She couldn't go to school. She only went for 6 grades. And she started then to work in my father's pharmacy. What her work consisted of was she was the person who took the medicine that people ordered to their houses.
She would deliver. Mm-hmm.
She was a delivery girl, mm-hmm. Yes. And so, but she got to know Ivan, my brother, who fell in love with her. And from that time on, Ivan was unwilling to do anything in the world unless Erzsi is there. Mm. So after some weeks of discussions and problems, Erzsi arrived as a nanny in our house.
And she essentially became like a sister to you and Ivan and like, yes, a daughter to your parents.
Yes, that is right. And after the war, my parents have adopted her, mm-hmm, indeed. But before that, she was playing with us. She loved us. She was 12 years old, 13 years old. She has never, ever had any toys. She has never, ever had the opportunity to play with anyone because she was working constantly. And when she was at home, when she was 5 or 6, she had to take care of the smaller children. She had to help in the kitchen. She never, ever could play. And there she arrived in our house into a fairy tale world. Mm-hmm. Really going through it for the first time as a person who is already quite conscious of her growing up, but suddenly she was allowed to be a child again. And so she lived with us and she played with us and she continued these wonderful fantasy games with us.
And later she would be the only person, she was a Gentile, and she was, yes, the only person who had the freedom to try to take care of the family.
Yes, that is right. In 1944, when the Germans came in and when Jews were forbidden to walk on the street except in certain hours of a day, it is she who brought us food. It is she who has provided us with everything. She who bought us games. She who has done everything for us so that we could live on without suffering terrible need during the summer of 1944.
So by then, your parents had moved to Budapest.
Yes.
Can you talk about how they were convinced to do that?
In 1938 came the first anti-Jewish law to Hungary, very much based on the Nuremberg laws. Mm-hmm. In 1939, the second, and in 1941, the third. But even before the third one came out, my uncle, Polly, who was a lawyer and lived close to the town where we lived, he started to convince my father to sell the pharmacy. But my father was desperate. He said he couldn't sell the pharmacy for anything it is worth. He would have to sell it for half price. But Polly insisted on it that he sells it. At the end, he sold it really on half price. And we could move then to Budapest. But the pharmacy would have been taken away from my father because of the third anti-Jewish law in 1941. As my grandfather was taken his pharmacy away from, and as all Jews in Hungary were taken their pharmacies and their businesses away from.
So it was helpful that your father sold in time.
It was very helpful. And we moved to Budapest, where my father had a good friend, a childhood friend, who was decorated with a gold medal because of his role in the First World War. And therefore, interestingly enough, he didn't count as a Jew. So he could start a new business, and my father bought in the money he got for the bicycle, for the pharmacy. And so they had then a bicycle shop, the two of them. And so, interestingly enough, that went quite well, and they earned quite well, and we had a quite nice and good life, while other Jews, most of them, were living without jobs and had suffered terrible needs.
I want to talk about your Uncle Polly, because he was the one who convinced your father to sell the business. He was drafted into the Hungarian army, as many young Jewish men were, but they were never used as soldiers.
No, they were never used as soldiers, but they were really servicemen. They were really dealt with as slaves, but then as the war went on, they were dealt with much worse than ever anyone had dealt with, have been dealt with.
They were tortured in many cases.
They were taken. There were altogether about 50,000 servicemen taken to the front, the Eastern Front, in 1941, out of whom 5,000 survived, but not because they stayed alive, because they could survive that treatment, but because they became POWs. Mm-hmm. The rest really was torture to death. They were labor servicemen. That was their official name. And they had to go in summer clothing. They were drafted. And if they took in their backpack some winter clothing, that was taken away from them. So they had to go in summer clothing to the front, which became a rag on their backs within a month or two. And they really had to work, just completely senseless work, like cutting out trees and helping to build the roads, but they were really not allowed to do anything. They were just nominally standing there and building the road, but they froze to death, they were tortured to death, and they were shot to death.
And your uncle never came home.
My uncle never came home. That was my father's most horrific pain throughout his entire life, that my uncle has never come home.
Never slept a full night after that.
My father could never live as he did before because of that. Even when he was smiling, he was somehow smiling sadly.
And you write that even now sometimes you leave a light on for your uncle.
That's right. We got to use, basically, that my uncle won't return. He has only said in the last year or two of his life, in 1963 and 64. Before that, it was always that maybe my uncle got lost in a village and maybe he forgot who he is and maybe he will remember and then maybe he will come or maybe he got a terrible injury and it takes him many years to recover. And there were always some ideas that we had, and he agreed with us that this is really the reason why my uncle hasn't yet returned and that he might still return. And so we always left the lights on at night when we left the house because we wanted him to know that we are there and waiting for him. Even though he will ring the doorbell and nobody will open the door, he would know that we are there. And if we are indeed there, he would come in and he would be in our arms. And so then we came to America, and I just could never give that up. So I very often just ran out of into the other room to turn on the light that he should see it.
Zsuzsanna Aschvat is my guest. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red. Let's go to Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I'm loving this program, and I've always been fascinated and almost obsessed with the Holocaust and the survivor stories and those that participated in the actual atrocities. What I was wondering, the question I was going to ask is, at any time did she remember as a child or just struggling in Hungary during that time period of anyone that deliberately betrayed her and her family or turned their back on them?
Yes, my father's colleagues, when we lived in Békéscsaba, in that town where my father had a pharmacy, they were very competitive. And they indeed were telling their clients not to shop in a Jewish pharmacy because one never knows what a Jew does and so on. Then in 1944, when the Germans came in and my father tried to get false papers for us, many of his friends apparently said that they couldn't give their papers or that they themselves are frightened or that they wouldn't want to risk something of that sort. And so they didn't. I think that he has gone through many such terrible disappointments. I was more a child at that time, so I never asked a single friend of mine to help. So, in a way, it never even came around that question. But my father, yes.
There was a point, Zsuzsi, when Erzsi found you a spot that seemed safe in a convent school for refugee girls, and you were told to tell them that you were a Christian. And eventually, I guess you told your roommate. And I found that so moving because on the one hand, you knew you couldn't tell anyone, and yet you were lonely, you were scared, and you were a little girl.
Yeah. Yeah, they tried to train me for months that if I would be alone, if it would get to this that we have to be alone, that we are not going to be in the same place, the four of us, but in different places, that I have to learn my name and I have to learn my religion and I have to learn the place where I was born and I have to behave as that girl would behave. Her name was Zsuzsanna Ákom, A-K-O-M. And so, yes, in a way there were all kinds of attempts made that I learned how to deal with this situation. And then when I was in it, I never wanted to play that game. Mm-hmm. I never wanted to go along, and I never wanted to be Zsuzsanna Ákom, and I always got out of it with some kind of excuse. But then at the end, I was Susanna Akom, and I was in that place, and this girl came to me, and I was alone. It was horrific. I always thought of Hannah and about the marketplace, and at that time there was already bombing in Budapest, and constant shots on the streets and everywhere. It was very frightening, and somehow, in a way, I was supposed to be that girl, and there was another real girl standing next to me, and I told her that I am Jewish, and that my parents are hiding somewhere else, and my brother, and then I had to leave the nunnery.
Because you had put them in danger as well as yourself.
Because I put them in danger as well as myself. That's right.
Were you ashamed after that? Were you glad it was over and you didn't have to pretend? How did you feel?
I was. I think very much relieved, mm-hmm. because I saw Ergie again. I was terribly lonely there, and totally in absolute despair. I thought I will never see my father again. I thought I am going to die there alone. So I was very much relieved that Ergie came to pick me up, although I caused the whole family terrible headaches and terrible problems.
Zhuzhana Ashvat is my guest. She's Leah and Paul Lewis Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of Literature and the History of Ideas at UTD. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zhuzhana Ashvat. She is Leah and Paul Lewis Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of Literature and the History of Ideas at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red. So at the end of all this, Budapest is under siege. Your family is finally all together, all four of you, in what looked to the outside world like a White Cross hospital.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I asked some years ago when I was in Budapest, some people, why was this a White Cross hospital? And no one seemed to know. As a matter of fact, I asked this question a lot, even before I concretely asked a friend of ours. And the answer was, well, that's the name. That what was the name of it was. I mean, it was White Cross Hospital. So it has nothing to do with the Red Cross. It's a White Cross Hospital. So there I was, there we were. This was a complicated place. I still don't know until today's date, and I don't really know whether or not one could find out what kind of... one cannot find out... Better to speak, one could find out all the sources that were behind it. Mm-hmm. I know only a few. There were Jews who paid. There were, I think, National Socialists who knew that the coming of the Russians is a matter of 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was clear. Budapest was completely surrounded and was shot at day and night, and there were tens of thousands of German soldiers and Hungarian soldiers who died. I mean, that there in Budapest. And half of Hungary was already occupied by the Russians. So there were some real National Socialists, Hungarian National Socialists, called the Nyilas, who were just simply trying to act as if they would be taking care that we are not getting into some Jewish bad things.
So they were trying to save their own skins, you think?
And then, but the real reason was to save their own skins after the war is over.
Yeah,
that was another group. Then there was a group of young Zionists, who some of whom were dressed up as policemen, some of them were dressed up as National Socialists, but they told us that they are Jews.
So it was never a hospital at all.
It was never a hospital, but it was. It had several official doctors, and it had bunk beds in which you were supposed to lie all day, even before you went to the basement, to the bunker where we were under the siege for 3 weeks.
So finally the Russians come in and liberate the city, and you tear off your stars and you walk outside for the first time in weeks. Can you talk about what that day felt like?
It was an incredible sense of freedom. I mean, it was already, as the Russian soldiers came in, there were 12 of them coming in, huge guys, coming in with the question, are there any German soldiers? It was an incredible, it really... It was a kind of a liberation that is really very difficult to describe just in a few words. It was gaining not freedom back, but life back. It was a tremendous experience.
But the city was in ruins. I mean, was that joy followed by, right behind by this wave of just sorrow?
Yes, as we went through Budapest, from that very place to our home, it was, we did know that it was bombed day and night, and the house, the White Cross Hospital where we were, was bombed down. Only people in the bunkers survived, and the upper floors were completely leveled. But we didn't know that the whole city looks like that. But it did. It was completely leveled. I mean, there was no house. As we walked on the main boulevards and the main streets, that was not totally bombed down. So people really survived only in the bunkers. In a way, towards our place where we lived in a place in... quite far from the White Cross Hospital, in a way that is close to a big park. And that part was less bombed. So the house where we have lived by that time for 4 or 5 years, that house was not bombed down. The apartment stayed almost untouched, except all windows, of course, and all doors were broken and so on. But otherwise, the apartment itself, the house itself, was not bombed down. And so Erzsi lived in it. So that meant that no one has taken away anything.
And you were, what was the, what was it like when you were reunited with Erzsi?
It was incredibly moving. She has, I just remember that she was running towards us and I was running towards her, and I took her in my arms and she was sobbing and I was sobbing and everybody else was sobbing, and we just knew that she is not only our sister and relative and friend, but we also knew that she is an extraordinary human being, the like of which you almost never see in your life. She has risked her life 1,000 times for saving us, and she has taken upon herself the most horrific dangers that you can imagine. People were on the streets for food sometimes that they try to get for their families, for their children, for their mothers. And she was running for miles and miles to put me from one place to another, my brother from one place to another. She didn't have means to do this. She didn't have money. She had nothing, just herself.
Let's go to the phones now. This time we will speak with Leslie in Dallas. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My name is Leslie Kitziger, and I called in not with a comment. Your guest sounds just like my grandmother. I'm a first-generation American. My family's from Russia, and it's just bringing tears to my eyes. I miss my grandmother. And just to hear her, you know, hear you talking about this, and people tend to forget, and my grandparents always told me, you know, you need to remember, you need to remind people of what, you know, we went through, and it just makes me just happy to hear you on the show and to hear your voice.
Thank you very much.
Talk for a minute, Zsuzsi, about why we discussed this a little bit before the show started, that you've written about the subject of the Holocaust for decades. You hadn't written your own story.
No, I haven't written my own story because my children know everything and my husband knows everything and we are talking. The Holocaust is very much part of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have the best life and the most beautiful life on earth, but nonetheless, this has nothing to do with it. That in a way, I all this what happened is as much alive in me as if it had happened yesterday. But so I didn't have a need for myself to write it down. And as far as, you know, other people are concerned, I mean, I am happy to go anywhere and talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I didn't feel a great urge to write about it. But then I was invited to a conference that had the title, as I told you, The Writer Uprooted, colon, Contemporary Jewish Exile Literature. And somehow that title created something in me, so I sat down and I wrote an article which went probably 59 times faster than any other article I have ever read, I have ever written in my life. And I just have written in it about 10 pages. The article is 40 pages now, and it appeared in a book, but about 10 pages, I would say, discusses the Holocaust. And I just had a feeling as I wrote down those 10 pages that I want to say more. And so shortly after, I started to write this memoir, which went so fast that I have never written anything as fast in my life as this.
Were there things that you remembered in the writing process that you hadn't thought about in years?
No.
It's all there for you all the time.
Yes.
That seems like a terrible burden to carry.
It's not. It's somehow an incredible pain because of my father, who had a terribly difficult life, and then he lost his beloved brother, and his sister was killed in Auschwitz, and he somehow had all his happiness in the world in us, but then there was this huge wound that there was forever, and I couldn't make it good. And so that was very difficult. That is very difficult. But for me to live with it, I think it has enormous importance. I think it is something that has, I mean, not my story, but the whole event has been greatly influential on 20th century culture and history, that it is with us in every moment, even if we don't know about it. It has made such an incredible impact. The very fact that this can happen and that this has nothing to do with things that we believe that are important for such a thing to happen. It's not a question that they were people whom you could identify before as murderers. It is not yeah. such... It is a lot of things that somehow came terribly naturally at the same time, unfathomably. And so it really has asked basic questions about culture and about the ways in which we live and about the ways we have chosen for ourselves. For me personally, I mean, basically, I have a wonderful life. I have my wonderful husband and two wonderful children, and I have a really a miraculously beautiful job at UTD, and I have many students, and they are wonderful. And the program is, the Holocaust Studies program is growing and is developing beautifully. So basically, I have a very full and wonderful life. I mean, besides this past.
Are you afraid the world will forget when there are no more survivors to tell the stories firsthand?
I somehow, strangely enough, unlike many other people, I don't. I think it has marked our way of life in which we think about the universe. I think it will bring huge changes further on. I don't think that it will be forgotten. It cannot be forgotten. It is embedded in our flesh. It is part of the air that has the ashes of millions of people.
My guest this hour has been Zhuzhana Ashvat. She is Leah and Paul Lewis Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of Literature and the History of Ideas at the University of Texas at Dallas. Her new book is called When the Danube Ran Red. Zhuzhi, it's been wonderful to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.